Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 159 of Sign Language. Got a few responses to episode 158, which was nice. So I will address some of the email and then we'll get on to another dissection. The first email was from Ernie Barrett, who I've not heard from for a while. Good to hear from you, Ernie. And he said, "So I read this little short that you wrote. Great stuff." And Ernie's referring to the primer for non-audio engineers, which you'll find on signlanguagepodcast.com. It's the last post prior to episode 158. My question, or maybe more like a thought process probe, when you were talking about the amplifiers and noise, isn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, the reason why some people try to go as high as they can with recordings is to drown out or mask the amplifier noise or source amplifier noise? Most of this depends on the quality of the gear you have, but let's say I'm recording a flute or a voiceover. If I record at a low volume, there'll be more noise you can hear. If I record at higher volumes without trying to peak, the source will drown out the noise, at least in my experience. Unless, of course, you're talking about recording at whatever level you want and then bringing it into the mix slash mixer slash DAW at, for example, the drums no louder than minus 20 dB. What I'm getting at is this. An example, I recorded a voiceover of myself. Being a mistake or just ignorance, the recording was at a low volume, let's say minus 24 dB. With that comes A, mic preamp noise, B, line mixer noise, and C, audio interface noise. Now, in Audition, when I increase the level to minus 12 or minus 6 dB, with that comes the increased level of noise. Whereas if I recorded at, let's say, minus 12 or minus 6, the final result would be a lot less audible amplifier noise, right? Or if I just completely derailed the train. No, Ernie, you're pretty much on the money. The whole premise here, and I've mentioned this in the past, is every amplification stage, and there are many of them in a signal chain, right? If we were to talk our way through a hypothetical signal chain, right, you've got microphone goes to a mic preamp. So that gain control knob on the mic preamp is an amplifier stage. Now, if that mic preamp happens to be, you know, a 19-inch rack-mounted unit that is entirely dedicated to being a channel strip, there could be other amplifier stages within that device beyond just the mic preamp. If there is EQ in that channel strip, then each of those boost and cut controls is an amplifier. If there is a compressor in that channel strip, which has an output gain stage, that's another amplifier. If there is an overall output level driver for the output of the mic preamp unit, then that is another amplifier stage, right? Likewise, if we were plugging our microphone cable just straight into the XLR jack on a mixing console, then you're going to have a channel strip on the console, which is basically the same sort of set out. You know, you've got a mic preamp up the top of the desk. That's an amplifier. You've then got various, you know, configurations of EQ depending on the desk. Each of those boost and cut knobs is an amplifier. The actual channel fader is an amplifier. Any auxiliary sends that go from that channel off to the, you know, send one bus, send two bus, whatever, those send controls are amplifiers. So everywhere throughout the chain, and obviously, you know, if we follow the signal path through a hardware mixer, then you get to the master outputs. You've got your stereo fader or a pair of faders for the master output. That's another amplification stage. And every one of these amplifier stages has, shall we call it, a Goldilocks zone where everything is just right, where it's not too hot and it's not too cold. It's unity gain is how we refer to it. And essentially, unity gain is that point at which that particular amplifier stage, and I'm talking about every single one of the various potential amplifier stages that I just mentioned, is working at its optimum level, where if you drive it any lower, then you are reducing the ratio between the signal you want and the noise that you don't want. So the noise is a constant, but the signal can vary if you're not driving the amplifier hard enough. If you drive the amplifier beyond the Goldilocks zone, and I'm mainly talking about analog circuitry here, then the amplifier starts to saturate. And at first you'll get some pleasant harmonics, but you drive it too far and it goes into distortion, right? And how that distortion manifests itself will vary depending on what type of amplifier it was. So, yeah, this is all part of gain staging. And the idea is that you, in the recording phase, want to have your gain structure optimized to the absolute nth degree as much as you can. Now, obviously, you know, when you are recording a source whose level can vary at unpredictable rates, then you need to dial in a certain measure of, you know, wiggle room, shall we say, right? If you're working with a vocalist who, you know, might every now and again get really loud, then you kind of need to set yourself up for that in advance. You know, you don't want to start recording, particularly if it's a, you know, a live event where you don't get a second chance. You know, so you want to try and set levels to allow for every possibility. And this comes down to knowing the source, knowing what you're going to be presented with during a recording or a live event, and being able to set your gain structure accordingly. You know, the type of work I do, it's all pre-recorded. I generally don't involve myself in any form of live audio work because it is a completely different discipline to studio work, and it's not my forte. You know, it's not something I've spent time doing. I'm sure I could do it if I wanted to dedicate myself to it, but I don't. I love studio work. Studio work gives me the opportunity to do things multiple times to make sure I get it right. Like I said, completely different discipline from live work. So the idea is that you are going to work with, you know, whatever incoming signal it is that you are recording, and hopefully you'll have an opportunity to hear that source before you actually have to hit record, and that way you can set your levels in advance. So when it comes to tracking, what we want to do is we want to optimize, you know, the mic preamp, the channel fader, EQ if it's being used. I tend not to record with EQ at all. I would much prefer to use the right microphone and get the signal pretty much the way I want it to sound without any EQ if I can. And then, you know, if EQ is required, I'm happy to do it as a non-destructive thing at mixdown. So we've set our mic preamp level, and, you know, we've adjusted compression if we're going to track with compression, and we've set a level going into the ADC of our digital recorder, whatever that digital recorder's form may be. It might be, you know, a rack-mounted hardware recorder like I'm recording to right now, my Marantz unit. It might be the input of a sound card on a computer. It might be, you know, a little handheld recorder with a digital input. Doesn't matter what it is. What we've done is we've tried to optimize our gain stage as much as possible so that as many of those amplifier stages as possible are running at unity gain. Now, the thing about the signal going into the ADC is we need to be aware of the RMS level, right? This is where, you know, you've heard me talk in the past about crest factor, the difference between the peak level and the RMS level. With something like a vocalist, where the peaks generally, unless maybe you're working with an opera singer, the peaks tend to be very short, sharp, transient things, right? And the RMS level is a heck of a lot lower than the peak level. With something like that, a voice, you could aim to hit peaks of minus 3 dB full scale and not have any issues whatsoever. But you take something like a distorted, overdriven electric guitar, where the crest factor is much, 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 much lower, where the peak level and the RMS level are much closer together, that's where it becomes critical to not try and drive the signal in too hard into the ADC. Because what happens is that what we're driving in, although it might not be peaking at 0 dB full scale, it's still too hot. This is where I will confess I'm getting to the limits of my understanding, but basically if the RMS level is too hot, you can still overload the ADC even though you're not hitting 0 dB full scale. I really need to brush up on my understanding of why that is the case. But I can absolutely confirm from personal experience, you know, working with Dave recording the current album that we're working on, that it absolutely does make a difference. When it comes to recording electric guitars, I will aim for peaks of, you know, minus 12, even minus 15, and they just sound richer. I don't know. Like I said, I really need to brush up on the why, but it certainly does make a difference. Now, all of that is just the recording side. And I suspect that what you were referring to in your email was my philosophy with regards the mixdown, right? So my workflow is that I will record most things between minus 3 and minus 8 dB peak, unless it was something like a heavily distorted electric guitar, in which case I will aim for a lower peak level. And then when I start my mix, and again, I hope you recall hearing me say this, in my DAW, the master faders for the, you know, for the two bus never, ever move from unity gain. My approach is build the mix so that without any peak limiting, without any compression on the two bus, you will get to the end of constructing your mix and still not be lighting up red lights on the two bus. Okay. Now, you could argue, hey, Bruce, that's really overkill because all of our DAW environments are doing, you know, 32-bit floating point math or 64-bit floating point math, you know, so it wouldn't matter. And you would be absolutely correct in saying that. It wouldn't matter because the floating point arithmetic of the mix bus allows you to then pull that level down before you feed it out to the DAC, the digital to analog converter, and not suffer any consequences. But I'm old school. I grew up in the analog world where on an analog console, the outcome of bringing up more and more faders from your tape playback, as it was in my day when I started, causes an additive effect, right? So for every every extra channel that you bring into a mix, you know, at the same level as the previous channel, then you've added 3 dB to what's hitting the master bus, right? So the idea is to start building this mix plenty low enough so that by the time your entire mix is built, you're not going to be lighting up red lights on the two bus, right? So if I was mixing something that was just an acoustic guitar and a vocalist, I'd probably start with the vocal peaking at minus 6, and then I'd just bring the acoustic guitar up under it, and, you know, I'd get it to a nice healthy level. It'd be sitting somewhere between 0 and minus 3, allowing for, you know, occasional transients. I'd slap a little bit of compression on it and a peak limiter to set my output exactly where I wanted it, and Bob's your uncle. However, if I'm doing something that's a lot more complicated, you know, a full rock band track where there's 8 tracks of drums, bass, you know, half a dozen guitar tracks, a lead vocal, 3 or 4 backing vocals, maybe 1 or 2 keyboard passes and, you know, some synth strings, you know, suddenly you're looking at north of 20 audio tracks. Now, admittedly, well, certainly on most of the stuff I've worked on, you're not going to have all of that stuff happening at once, although it's possible that by the time you get towards the end of the song, you might have almost all of the tracks with signal on them. So I will construct my mix in such a way that, you know, I'll build my drums mix, all of which, you know, let's say I've got 8 tracks of drums, they'll all be feeding into a drum submix, right? So I will build the mix of the drums so that the kit sounds cohesive, and I'll then drop the submix for the drums down so that the peaks are hitting, you know, probably minus 15. And then I'll bring in the bass guitar. And then I'll get a nice balance between the bass guitar and the drums. And then I'll have all of my guitar parts routed into a guitar submix. So I can then solo the guitar submix and I can start mixing all the guitars together so that they're working at a nice level relative to each other. Things that should be louder than other things sound like they are louder than the other things. For example, if you've got an electric guitar part and an acoustic guitar part, it doesn't make sense for them to both be heard at exactly, you know, a similar level, because that's just not the nature of electric guitars and acoustic guitars. So I would expect the electric guitar to sound like it was a bit louder than the acoustic guitar. So I will build my guitar mix just listening to the guitars only. And then I'll unsolo the guitar submix and then ride that level relative to the drums and bass mix. And then I'll bring in, you know, whatever other parts, whether it's strings or keys or whatever. I think I said this in that particular blog post. I will basically aim to build an absolutely rockin' instrumental mix. And once I've got that, I will then ride my lead vocal over the top of that mix with automation if necessary. And I will do my best to get that vocal performance into the ballpark without any compression if I can do so, right? Sometimes you just have to put the compressor on there and still ride the mix, but I generally try and automate the lead vocal without any compression happening first. If I can get it in the ballpark, I know then that I can put a compressor over the top, and generally the automation will affect the input level to the compressor before, you know, the full strength of the signal hits it. Sorry, I'm getting a bit sidetracked here. And so once I've done that, I'll then bring my backing vocals in underneath my lead vocal, and hopefully by this stage, when you're getting close to the end of the mix, all of these things have cumulatively added up on the mix bus, and what started out as, you know, drums peaking at minus 15 is now something close to a full-on mix that's, you know, hopefully hitting the 2 bus somewhere between 0 and minus 6 dB full scale, at which point, you know, I can throw on a compressor and a peak limiter and do my thing. You know, those are two extremes, you know, acoustic guitar and vocal versus, you know, a 20-plus track rock mix. For the type of stuff I do with commercial production for radio, it's still the same workflow. It's just somewhere in the middle of all of that. But as I've said in the past, when it comes to radio production, I always start with my voice first. And when I say my voice, I mean my voiceover voice, right? If there is a scene within the commercial where it's, you know, 2 people who are supposedly, you know, quote unquote in real life, whether it's the proverbial 2 women in a coffee shop, or, you know, it's the 2 kids on the university campus or whatever it is, I'm not talking about those bits. I'm talking about the actual voiceover, the retail sell part of the commercial. That's where I'll start my mix, is get that voice happening exactly the way I want it to, hitting the master bus at, you know, probably -6 to -8 dB full scale. And I will build my entire commercial mix around that retail voiceover element of the mix. So if there's music to run under that retail bit, that'll go in next. And then if the, you know, if the front end of the commercial is, you know, one of those tacky aforementioned type scenes of, you know, people acting, blah, 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 I will then build that mix up, starting with the voices that carry that part of the ad first, so that they lead into the retail voiceover at a sensible level, and then I'll build the sound effects around those parts so that everything sits together nicely when it hits the two bus, and I can then throw some light compression across the two bus and some peak limiting to bring it up to level. And, you know, as you've heard me say a million times, I've got my Antres VU meter plug-in as the final thing in the chain. So I know that my peak limiter is keeping the peaks at -1 dB full scale, and the VU meter, I'm watching that as I adjust the threshold of my peak limiter, and I can just bring that threshold down, which brings the level of my entire mix up until such times as my VU meter is just sitting nicely at 0 VU. Now, I know it's only a digital approximation, but it's close enough for rock and roll. So, Ernie, a very long-winded response, matey. I hope that has cleared some of that up for you. And I hope I've answered the whole amplifier noise thing for you. The idea with, you know, the mixing is that if you tracked everything well in the first place, then you should have minimized the noise pretty well. Because the reality is, if you've tracked all your voices, you know, to peak at, say, -6 to -3 dB full scale, it's conceivable that when you come to the mixdown phase of whatever it is that you're making, you may not need that voice at unity gain. You know, it might need to go down in the mix in order to do what it needs to do within the context of the whole mix. So whatever minimal noise was there in the recording is only going to get pushed lower. Where it becomes an issue is if you've got too many signals that were recorded too quietly and you've got to bring all of them up, then you're potentially bringing in lots of different bits of noise, you know, from each of those tracks and raising them up. So hopefully that answers that. If I have still not made this clear, please sing out again and ask, you know, for which bits I'm not being clear on, and I will do my best to expand on it a little further. All right, so moving on. Next email was from Steve Mayfield. Good to hear from you, Steve. Hi, Bruce. Just listened to this app. Love the new feature of dissection. Being able to follow along with the screenshots is perfect and makes it nice and easy to visually see what you're describing. I like this. Even though I've never heard of Steinberg Nuendo 4.5 software, it matters less as the basics are more or less the same as most audio editing and creation software. I'm still using Audition, which suits my small needs well. So, a thumbs up for this new feature. Rob's emails are always fun, aren't they? I do recall the attempt to bring the Pono device to the masses, and was interested, till 1, I saw the shape of it, yuck, and 2, the price. Way too expensive for an MP3 player, which, no matter how much you colour it up, is still an MP3 player. Thing is, like you say, most people use their phones for this now, including me, and I don't want another device to carry around when the phone does a pretty good job, as long as it's a reasonably good one, of course. I have a Lumia 930 at present, and that has excellent sound. Do you have an opinion on the resurgence in popularity of vinyl again? I find it fascinating. Things are doing a full circle, it seems. I was one who embraced CD, being fed up with all the clicks and pops of records, including brand new ones. I was very happy when CDs came along,
but I still have LPs and have recently played some. It's fascinating for some reason. The worst part about it, though, is you can't just hit pause. All the best, Steve Mayfield.
Well, Steve, yeah, as for the vinyl thing, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned here, you know, I got back into vinyl about 4 years ago. It started with Max buying me Springsteen's Wrecking Ball on vinyl for Father's Day. And I put it on the very first time. And this was the first time I had listened to vinyl in, wow, I don't know, I'm going to say probably 15 years at least, possibly more. And I listened to it and just went, wow, that really sounds full. And of course, I had already heard the album digitally. And so what I did was I fired up Media Monkey and, you know, started playing We Take Care of Our Own, which was the lead single off the album, and had it simultaneously playing off vinyl. And both running through my little mixer here on my desk in my home studio, and I was able to just open the vinyl faders and shut the computer playback and then, you know, flick both to do an A-B comparison. And when you actually do an A-B comparison, the difference is chalk and cheese. It really is. And again, I'm pretty sure I've said this on the podcast, it's not just a width thing, it's like a front-to-back depth. Like you could reach into the sound stage, you know, from what's close to you to what's furthest away from you. It's it's funny, you know, because Glenn and I were only talking about this notion on this week's episode of Shutters Inc., my photography podcast, because someone had mentioned about young photographers going back to shooting film. And Glyn posited the theory that it's because this generation have never had to deal with any form of delayed gratification. Everything is so instantaneous. Oh, have you seen this new Pokemon Go? It's great. You know, go straight to the App Store, download it, blah, blah, blah. Off you go. Heard this, you know, have you seen this great game, blah, blah. Have you heard this great new song? You know, just go to any online streaming service and you can play it and hear it straight away, you know, and everything's instantaneous. And he said, I think, you know, one of the appeals for those people who are into shooting film is the fact that you have to delay the gratification. And so there is a reward at the end when you finally get to see those images. And he felt that there was a corollary with vinyl, in that vinyl is not instant. You know, you got to turn your turntable on, get the vinyl out, give it a wipe. It's a bit of a routine, and you've got to make an effort. And it's a lot less instant than, you know, just press and play on the iPod or, you know, your music player on your phone. I'm not sure that I necessarily buy into that. I, for one, will argue for audio quality. I just think vinyl has a sound completely unlike digital playback. But, hey, each to their own. That's the beauty of art. It's subjective. There's no right or wrong. So, yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for the email. And finally, I heard from Rob Bettler via Skype. He said,
well, Sensei, I am pleased to tell you I just listened to the latest episode and the dissection was excellent. To be honest, I expected you to come up with a new idea to either kill or revitalize the Lazarus podcast, but I did not expect you to go into so much detail when explaining the work behind the production of the paintball ad. This is something that I truly did not expect and has great potential, especially if there's video of it in the near future. I'm very glad that you decided not to kill the Unkillable podcast. By the way, I wanted to thank you for reading my rambling on the Z Phone fiasco.
Thank you, Rob. As for the video thing, that would be a little bit difficult simply because the commercials that I'm pulling out to use for these dissection episodes are commercials that I've made at work. And in order to do video, I would have to have some sort of screen capture software installed on the work machine. And A, I don't have any such software, and B, I wouldn't be allowed to install it on the work machine even if I did have it. So at this point, no, I don't see the video side of things happening anytime soon. If something changes that will allow me to do that, then I'll entertain that idea, Rob. But for the moment, no, it's just going to have to be as you experienced in episode 158, and which you're about to experience again now in episode 159. So, with all that done, we can move on to this episode's dissection. This commercial is for a church slash charity here in Australia called Anglicare. They are I guess you'd call them a charity run by the Anglican Church. Now, this commercial would be about 4 years old, and the reason I chose this particular commercial is because back around about the time that I made this commercial, ARN introduced what they called the Creative Fire Awards. And they are a set of awards which one is handed out each quarter. So there are five for the year, one for each of the quarters and an annual award. And the very first quarter that we had the Creative Fire Awards, I entered this commercial and won the Creative Fire Award. So I was the first joint recipient, because whoever the writer was also got the award, and I was the first production guy in the network to get the award. And so this was, you know, me against, I don't know, five or six other production guys at our other radio stations around the country. And so when I was thinking about what I was going to use as a source commercial for this episode, I had this in mind, and I thought, oh, yeah, that was a great commercial. Funny thing is, when I went back to it, I went, it's actually not that complicated. There wasn't really that much going on. But I guess it was just a combination of really good acting performances from the people who were involved as voice actors on this spot. And if I may say so, well executed on my part. And, you know, all of those things coming together made a great commercial that, you know, certainly the judges of the Creative Fire Awards felt made this the best commercial of all those that were entered in that particular quarter of 2012. So, enough rambling. I'll let you have a listen to the ad. Here we go.
First, we lost our car. Then, what? Our house.
An eviction notice.
Then Dad left.
No, I'm leaving!
Then Mum got sick and we couldn't have Christmas. Then one day, there was a phone call and Anglicare came to help.
Please, give to Anglicare's Christmas appeal today and give families and individuals the opportunity to improve their life. All donations in Sydney go back to helping the people of Sydney.
Anglicare, the care that changes lives.
All right, so that was the whole commercial. The second screenshot and the next piece of audio that I'll play you is just Kate, the young girl who's narrating the story to begin with, and Joe, who did the retail voiceover at the end, with all of the EQ, peak limiting, compression, everything taken out. So the screenshot shows the processing that was on the voiceover submix. But if you look closely, you'll see a little yellow icon in the top left of both of those plug-in windows, and that's signifying that they are both in bypass. So here we go. This is just the voice parts. And this is not the actors. This is just the narration and the retail voiceover. Here we go.
First, we lost our car. Then our house. Then Dad left. Then Mum got sick and we couldn't have Christmas. Then one day, there was a phone call, and Anglicare came to help.
Please, give to Anglicare's Christmas appeal today and give families and individuals the opportunity to improve their life. All donations in Sydney go back to helping the people of Sydney.
Anglicare, the care that changes lives.
Okay, so that's the two parts of the voiceover. The next part is the husband and wife who are, you know, having the domestic problems in the background of the commercial. In this instance, I have messed around a little bit with the playback levels just so that they're not stupidly quiet in the mastered version of this podcast. But obviously, you know, in the actual mix, they played a little bit softer than what you're about to hear them. So again, no EQ, the reverb sends have been deactivated. And if you have a look at the third screenshot, you'll see that I had the Waves IR1 impulse reverb set up to simulate the room of the, you know, the house in which this scene was supposedly playing out. If you zoom in, you can see on the left-hand side where it says convolution, original and current 1.70 seconds. It was a 1.7 second reverb, and it actually looks to me like I've shortened it somewhat, but I'm just sort of looking at the graphic there. It tails off a heck of a lot sooner than at 1.7 seconds, but anyway, not that it really matters. So all of that has been deactivated so that what you're about to hear is simply the voice parts as they were recorded in the studio. The idea was to record these well at a, you know, a good level, and then, like I discussed in response to Ernie's email, to then mix these things accordingly to give them a sense of space and drop them in the mix so they sat in the background, etc., etc., etc. So here we go. This is the acting voice parts by themselves.
What? An eviction notice?
Nah, I'm leaving!
Okay, so the next piece of audio is exactly what you just heard, but with the EQ and the reverb sends reactivated. So here we go.
What? An eviction notice?
Nah, I'm leaving!
So as you can hear, I've been fairly heavy-handed with the reverb sends there because I wanted to create some distance between us, the eavesdroppers on this scene, and the people upon whom we were eavesdropping. I wanted it to be almost like we were standing outside their kitchen window and we're listening inside the house to all these things that are playing out. So I've been quite heavy-handed with the reverb there to, yeah, and because it's a fairly short reverb, it gives it that sound of, you know, a domestic kitchen, you know, hard surfaces, small room. That's what I was going for. Hopefully it worked. I mean, obviously somebody thought it worked. They gave me an award for it. So anyway, okay, so now we will move on to the actual sound effects, which are supporting all of this voiceover stuff. So the very first thing you hear in the commercial, or under the first part of the commercial, is some outdoor ambience of, you know, which is meant to just convey, you know, your regular suburban environment. Now, I've separated them here because I actually layered two different sounds together. So I'll play you these two sounds, and then I'll play the whole sound effects mixed together so you can actually hear how these things layer together. So this is the first one. So as you could hear, bit of distant traffic noise and a dog barking and, you know, the odd bird tweeting in the background. Then I had a second ambience which sounded like this. Okay, so it was a car driving off. And I've layered those two things together, I guess, to give, you know, a sense of, hey, we're just in a neighborhood somewhere in the suburbs here. Now, if you go to the fourth screenshot, you will see all of the sound effects tracks laid out in my track lay innuendo with all of the automation lanes that were active exposed so that you could see what automation was happening. So on effects 1 and 2, which are the two outdoor Atmos things, there was actually nothing happening. They were just set at a static level and they played through. On track three, which was indoor, I had a baby crying, and then that disc 10004 is a refrigerator hum, which you'll hear in a second. And you can see there's a bit of volume automation there, and there's also the send. So both of those were being sent to the reverb to create the sense that they were inside the house. Then on track FX4 indoor, we've got the slam sound effect, and then we've got the phone ringing. Then on FX5, I'd have to actually listen to it, but I think that was the hand slamming on the... No, sorry. The one that was on FX4 was the hand slamming on the bench, and then the next one was the door slamming as Dad walks out, and then FX6 was the footsteps of him, you know, saying, nah, I'm out of here and I'm leaving. Okay, so with all that in mind, here we go with the sound effects track. So there you go. And then when you put it all together, you end up with the finished mix. All right. So I hope, again, that this has been useful to somebody. If there's anything that I've done in these, you know, dissections that you want me to expand on, please sing out. You know, more than happy to explain further if there's more that I can add to the story that will help you out in your... you know, whatever your audio projects happen to be. All right, that will do it for this week. Good to hear from some people. It's good to be getting this podcast rolling again. I did feel like I sort of went through a bit of a an absence of inspiration, I guess. You know, it's good to have some ideas of things to cover. So anyway, good to be back. All right, please drop me an email. Any questions, comments, or feedback to studio@audiotu.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.